A reading from Lamentations. How lonely sits the city that once was full of people. How like a widow she has become, she that was great among the nations. She was a princess among the provinces that has become a vassal. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has no one to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile with suffering and hard servitude. She lives now among the nations and finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to the festivals. All her gates are desolate, her priests groan, her young girls grieve, and her lot is bitter. Her foes have become the masters, her enemies prosper, because the Lord has made her suffer. For the multitude of her transgressions, her children have gone away, captives before the foe. From daughter Zion has departed all her majesty. Her princes have become like stags that find no pasture. They fled without strength before the pursuer. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to Luke. The apostles said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." The Lord replied, "If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, 'Be uprooted and planted in the sea,' and it would obey you. Who among you would say to your slave, who has just come in from plowing or tending the sheep in the field, 'Come here at once and take your place at the table'? Would you not rather say to him, 'Prepare supper for me, put on your apron, and serve me while I eat and drink. Later, you may eat and drink.' Do you thank the slave for doing what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that you were ordered to do, say, 'We are worthless slaves. We have done only what we ought to have done.'" The Gospel of Christ.
Over the last couple of Sundays, we've acknowledged that the sermons have seemed to be a little bit on the bleak side. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the idea of wondering where is God in the middle of the difficult circumstances that we find ourselves in, or that our world is going through, or whatever. And last week, we talked about what is it that we do if we're thinking that the world's going to end tomorrow. We, of course, wanted to move towards some kind of solution, or if that's not quite the right word, something to do about that situation. So in the first sermon, we said, well, we have to understand that God is with us, that there is nowhere that God is not, and so the peace that passes all understanding needs to guard us and keep us through those difficult times. So we had something to work towards in that first context. Last week, we drew a page from the story told about Martin Luther, that when he was asked, "What would you do if the world ends tomorrow?" he said, "I would plant a tree today." And so we talked about, even in the face of what we expect will be a significant change in our lives, that we should go ahead and do the next right thing, invest in life, and to take a future-oriented hope that will overcome our present existential fear. And I think there was something worth contemplating in both of those sermons. The embrace of the reality of the challenges that we face, but also the idea that there's something we can encourage ourselves by and encouraging ourselves to do in the face of those. However, I think there is an inadvertent tendency for us to take these things and kind of make them a one or the other kind of thing. An all or nothing kind of thing. The idea being that, okay, life is difficult and that's the case, and we got to understand that that's certainly the case and we feel bad about it, but we need to take hold of the peace that passes understanding. Or we might know that a significant change is coming in our world and we might not be happy about that, but we need to do the next right thing and find our hope in Christ. And while it is a good thing to try to get a hold of that peace and that hope, what the inadvertent tendency is, I think, because we're human beings, is to make this a one or the other. Rather than thinking about the difficulty, I have to take hold of that peace. And if I'm not taking hold of that peace, well, that means there's a bit of a problem, isn't there? I mean, if I'm a Christian, if I believe that God is present, if the Spirit of God is at work in me, leading me into all truth every day, then why would I stay worried about the difficulty? Why wouldn't I expect to hang on to that peace? But what if you're finding it difficult to find that peace? What if in the face of whatever dramatic change in your world is coming that you know is just around the corner, you're having a hard time embracing that hope? What is your response to be? You see, if we start to think that rather than this, we should be that, then on the one hand, we might think, well, I guess I better fake it till I make it. I really am still concerned about this, but I'm supposed to have the peace that passes understanding, so I'm just going to tell everybody that. Isn't it lovely that I have the peace of God, even though we're not feeling it yet? Or if we're concerned about what's going to happen next, I mean, surely I need to set an example and at the very least show that I'm trying, and so I just know that God's got everything in control, so I'm resting in that. And yet, at the same time, you might still be feeling the turmoil of the anticipation of what comes next. If we allow this to continue to develop too far, then what also can end up happening is we can start to think that to remain in that feeling of the pain is somehow wrong, or bad, or even sinful. Like, what's wrong with me that I can't take hold of the promise of God that that peace is there for me? How can I remain in this? Doesn't this mean I'm not trusting God? Doesn't this mean I don't believe the Word of God or something? Doesn't this mean that somehow I am still too focused on myself rather than fixing my eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith? It's a danger that we can let these thoughts begin to develop in this all or nothing sense. And I'm implying, as you might gather, that this is not a good idea. Now, certainly, we do want to find ourselves moving from a place of fear and anxiety and concern into a place where we do find that peace that transcends understanding. But it's not like you're one or the other, off or on, sinning or not sinning. We're on a journey. We are going through life. We are experiencing it step by step. And we cannot deny the reality of what it is that we experience. Our first reading was from the book of Lamentations today. The book of Lamentations is understood to have been written by the prophet Jeremiah, who firsthand experienced the siege of Jerusalem and its defeat. He was there watching people starve to death because of the siege. He saw the military campaign against Jerusalem. He saw people being killed by the sword. He saw the Jerusalem being burned, the temple being destroyed. And even though he was the one who would say, God has a plan and a purpose, and 70 years later you will be restored, Jeremiah never saw that. He instead, rather than being taken away to exile in Babylon, against his will, went down to Egypt and came to the end of his life there, never seeing Jerusalem again. And his last memory of Jerusalem being its destruction. And so the book of Lamentations is a collection of writings from Jeremiah about this very thing. Now, a lament is a sad song or a sad poem. It's written in particular because of a situation. And that's how this book opened. How lonely sits the city that was once full of people. How like a widow she has become. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Judah has gone into exile with suffering and hard servitude. The roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to the festivals. Her foes have become the masters. Her enemies prosper. From daughter Zion has departed all her majesty. And this is what the book of Lamentations is all about. Talking about how terrible this reality is. And I think it's rather remarkable that those that made the decision about which books would be included in the Hebrew Bible chose, I think, rather wisely to make sure that this book was in there. That that the Jewish priests and rabbis and scholars and scribes who were contemplating what books should form our scriptures, they said, let's keep this book in here. And I think it's good that they did, because it's a book that's telling it like it is. It's a book, especially if indeed it was written by Jeremiah, which in all likelihood it was, that this is Jeremiah's own thoughts. The guy who said, it's not going to be forever. God will restore. Nevertheless said, this is how horrible and terrible this is. Now, we as Christians understand that the Bible speaks to us, is authoritative for us. One of the questions is, how is it authoritative for us? And I think one of the ways that we can see Lamentations giving us instruction or giving us guidance is to let us know that we could say, in a manner of speaking, that we have permission to be sad. That it is to be expected that we would mourn. It's understandable that we experience grief. And there's no pretending about the grief. There's no pretending that it just seems terrible. That's part of the reason we rarely hear from the book of Lamentations on a Sunday morning. Because it's a sad book. That's part of the reason we tend not to have a processional hymn that is in a minor key and kind of mournful. I mean, unless it's Ash Wednesday. But this book is saying there's a reality to this grief. It's part of the human experience. And there's no hurry to say, you should be over this by now. Like, come on, yeah, Jerusalem's dead. Don't worry. 70 years later, God will restore it. Just get on with it. There's no suggestion that that's what's supposed to happen. Grief is a big category. It's a word that basically describes how we respond in the face of loss, whatever that loss may be. It could be the loss of a loved one, someone who's passed away. It could be the loss of something that we have found very precious to us. Things, you know, we usually call heirlooms and stuff like that. It might be the loss of a relationship. Perhaps you've spent a long career in a particular field, and then without expecting it, you're laid off, and you no longer have that career that was meaningful to you. Any kind of loss like this brings us to a point of grieving, a point of grief. And many studies have been done over the course of many decades in the field of psychology about human grief. And what has come to be the case over and over and over again is that when we experience grief, we tend to display any number of 5 different stages of grief. Oftentimes, the first thing we do is experience denial. The idea being, especially if we're hearing news secondhand, we didn't know, we get a phone call saying that something tragic has happened and someone we loved has died. Oftentimes our response is, no, it can't be. I just talked to this person yesterday. I can't believe that this has happened. There's no way. Denial is a natural response that we have to the news that we first receive that tells us we've lost something. There's also sadness, depression, which we would expect. We get sad when we realize someone has died, and it can be a deep sadness. It may not be clinical depression, but it is certainly a deep sadness that happens, and we would expect to be sad. But then sometimes also we respond with anger. Anger towards the person who caused the loss, whether it's because of theft or robbery or because a drunk driver crashed into somebody. Sometimes we're angry with God. How could you let this happen? Sometimes we're angry at the person who died. Why were you so foolish? Why did you do such risky behavior? Why have you left me alone? And that anger is a very natural response to our grief. We actually have another great example of this one in the scriptures as well. Psalm 137, which we chanted together today. And I expect you probably were somewhat disturbed by this song. I would hope that you were, because it doesn't mince words. It starts off by saying, by the waters of Babylon we sat down and wept when we remembered you, O Zion. So here's that sadness piece. This is written by somebody who had gone into exile. Jerusalem has been destroyed. They're now living in Babylon instead of Jerusalem. And they're saying, for the city. We remember what it used to be, and it's no longer. As for our harps, we hung them up. We're not singing psalms anymore. We're sad. This is horrible news. And then in verse 3, those who led us away captive asked us for a song, and our oppressors called for mirth. You can see that this would be a teasing kind of thing. Go ahead, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Sing us one of those songs you used to always sing about how great your city was, which is now lying in burning embers. Psalm 48 comes to mind. I remember singing a version of this when I was younger, so this is probably the King James version of the Bible, but it says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, the city of our God." And you can imagine that the Babylonians are saying to the Israelites in captivity, how great is that city now? Yeah, we beat you. And so they're sitting in Babylon, sad, grieving the loss of the city, the loss of the temple, the loss of standing. And then the psalm builds towards the end, and you chanted the words in verse 8, "O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy the one who pays you back for what you have done to us." This call for vengeance for what had happened. And then I had the dubious pleasure of reading verse 9, "Happy shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against a rock." The sentiment in this psalm is that the people would be thinking, when we were besieged, I saw my kids die of starvation. You've killed my kids. Someone should pick up one of your babies by the ankle and just flog his head against a rock as payment for what you have done. And the visceral anger in this psalm is how it ends. That's the last verse. Now, once again, the Bible is authoritative for us, and we ask, how is it authoritative? It's all too easy to imagine somebody saying, yeah, this is why, with the power of God, we can find vengeance on our enemies. So let's bulldoze Gaza. But Jesus says, wait a second, I see it differently. We're supposed to love our enemies. We're supposed to pray for those who persecute you. We're supposed to be people who exhibit love for neighbor. And who is my neighbor? Anybody else outside of who you are. What we see in the psalm and the fact that it remains is that we are not endorsing the course of action that the Israelites are calling for in this psalm, but nevertheless acknowledging the reality of the anger that often becomes part of the grief that we experience in times of tremendous loss. So there's often denial. There's often sadness, there's often anger, sometimes there's bargaining as well. We start to try to make a deal with God, especially if the grief is because of news we've received that someone we know and love is not going to be with us much longer because of a disease that has struck or whatever. And we might want to say, God, I'll do anything if we can reverse this. Somehow, I'll give away my money, whatever, like something. Just heal this person or don't let it be, and we can start doing that. And then, of course, the final stage is acceptance. That eventually we come to a place of realizing that this loss is our reality. That's part of the package. And so now, how do we keep moving on? The key thing about these stages of grief is to understand that they happen. That they are a normal part of a human response to grief. And it is important to recognize that it is not bad that this happens. It is not sinful that this happens. It is not somehow an evil thing that we would do this. I mean, come on, you're a Christian. You're supposed to believe that Jesus is right there, so you shouldn't be affected by grief like other people do. You should just be able to rise above it and believe that the Spirit of God is with you, and rather than being mired in depression, you should be able to embrace the peace that passes understanding and stand firm in your faith. But it's never all or nothing. The stages of grief are what we experience. Jeremiah experienced them. The writer of Psalm 137 experienced it. Jesus wept. Grief is part of the human package. And how we respond to it is part of the journey that we live in. Nobody wants to remain mired in depression. But to try to say to somebody, look, come on, don't you think it's been long enough? You got to snap out of this. When are you going to embrace the promise of the Bible? When are you going to embrace the promise of God and get out of that hole? That's not helping the person get out of the hole. No one wants to remain in these situations. And one day, acceptance will arrive, and we trust that learning of the grace of God and the things that we see in the scriptures, the peace that's promised to us, can help us realize that there is a reason to look forward and look ahead. But it's not like until you do, there's something wrong with you. No, you're simply experiencing the reality of grief. On Friday morning, I knew that the new Archbishop of Canterbury was going to be announced. And so early in the morning, I was watching the live stream from Canterbury Cathedral when Sarah Mullally, our new Archbishop of Canterbury, addressed the crowd that was there. And in her remarks, she was talking about the challenging things that we're facing in the world. And she said something that I took note of, in part because I kind of talked about it a week ago, and I knew I was going to be talking about this today, and I loved how she put it. She talked about the hope that we have in the face of all of these challenges that we go through. And she said, hope does not skip over grief, pain, and the messiness of life, but enters into it and tenderly tells us that God is with us. I love that turn of phrase. Hope does not skip over grief, pain, and the messiness of life. If we are in too much of a hurry to get to this position we think we're supposed to be, we're tempted to think that we should be able to skip over it. But no. Instead, hope enters into that grief, pain, and messiness and tenderly tells us that God is with us. And here I'm reminded of Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And the image we see there is someone walking through the valley of the shadow of death. They're not running. They're not panicked. They're not, oh my goodness, I got to get out of here. They're walking through it. This is the journey. It's going to take however long it's going to take. And yes, it's a valley. It's not just a dip in the road. So who knows how long this valley is going to be? It doesn't matter. It's not an issue of right or wrong, sinning or not sinning. It's the reality of our experience. So even though I'm walking through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. I will endeavor to embrace the fact that you are with me. And as long as I am in this valley, you are right there with me anyway. However long I find myself in depression, God is still present, right there, never to leave. And so, this morning, I would hope that we are able, perhaps, to ease up a little bit on ourselves for whatever loss we've experienced, whatever grief we have experienced, and maybe still are experiencing it. And if there's any temptation to think that I just can't get over this, how do I get out of it? Give yourself some space. And please do not think that somehow you're doing something wrong if you're still finding yourself in that grieving process. The journey is what the journey is. Let's take hold of what is promised. Let it be the light at the end of the tunnel. Let it be what we continue to work towards and remind ourselves of. But let us be gracious to ourselves and to each other as we are on this journey, no matter what. Amen.